Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Late in the evening of September 13th, 2010, 19-year-old Samantha Clark was dressed in her pajamas and watching TV in her Orange, Virginia home. But after receiving a call, she told her brother she was going out and would be back in the morning. Samantha left her home and has never been seen again. Police had few clues to work with, but did zero in on a person of interest almost immediately. However, a lack of evidence made the case go cold. Then, 3 years later, another teenager disappeared just miles away, and police were certain that the two crimes were connected. Everything seemed to be falling into place, but now, over 14 years since she was last seen, answers in Samantha's case remain elusive. A break in her case seems like it's just over the horizon. The question is, who will deliver it? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Samantha Clark. I'm Conan Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode, and he's here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. So I stumbled across this case randomly, I think on Facebook or something, and even though it happened just a few hours from us in an area that we frequent, I've never heard of it.
Oh my God, a case you haven't heard of?
I know. So once I started researching it, it seems that even though police did seem to be diligently investigating and the local paper did update frequently, it never really received the amount of national attention that other nearby cases did. So this is right around the same time as Morgan Harrington and Alexis Murphy's disappearance. And those did get a lot of national attention. And this is the same time also that Sage Smith went missing in Charlottesville. And we've covered that on our show before. And her family had the same complaint, which is basically like these other cases really overshadowed the fact that she also went missing from the same area at around the same time. So what's interesting, though, is that it seems as though Samantha's case is actually linked to at least one of these cases that I just mentioned.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so I want to really give this the extra push that I think it could use so that maybe somebody who's listening out there who may know something can come forward. Before we get started, though, we've had a few new members join us over on Patreon. So we want to give a shout out to Kelly M., Tabitha, Cassie, and David T. Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you all so much.
Remember, if you join us there on any level, starting at just $2 a month, you can get these episodes ad-free, and you get a free copy of the ebook that I wrote. And then also, don't forget, I have my new podcast, Day by Day, True Crime Stories. You can subscribe to it wherever you're listening to this. It's also a video podcast, so it's available on YouTube and on Spotify if you're into that sort of thing.
And for those listeners that have complained about me, I'm not involved in that podcast. So you can get a full 10 to 15 minute episode of Nothing But Kona.
Yeah, which I don't know, but they're short little bite-sized episodes talking about a crime that happened this day in history. So, you know, a little history, a little true crime, just something for your morning commute. So be sure to check that out if you haven't already. So now with all of that out of the way, let's get into the story of Samantha Clark. Samantha Ann Clark was born on July 17, 1991, to Barbara Tinder. She's now one of three children. She has a younger brother, Hunter, who's about 7 years younger, and her mother gave birth to another baby boy about a year after her disappearance. Barbara was only 16, though, when Samantha was born, and Samantha's father was in his 30s.
Okay. Jail time associated with this or
not? No? At all. Barbara actually ended up dropping out of high school and temporarily moved in with him. The pair did stay together for a while, but when Samantha was a toddler, they separated. Barbara ended up moving in with family while Samantha stayed with her father. And she lived with him till she was about 12 years old. And at that point, she moved in with her aunt, Brenda Rhodes. And I have no idea what happened to her father after that. He's never been named in any of the source material. I don't know why she left when she was 12. I've never found any information about that.
Weird.
Yeah.
Also strange that, like, nobody pursued charges against him for...
It's a small town in the early 90s, and I feel like if your parents don't pursue charges, then, you know, nobody really will. And I don't know, again, what the situation was with her parents.
Yeah,
but
yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So in her early teens, after staying with her aunt for a while, she moved back in with her mother and her brother, Hunter, in Orange, Virginia. And Orange, Virginia is a small town in central Virginia, about 30 miles northeast of Charlottesville. Samantha attended Orange County High School and had just graduated in June of 2010. According to her mother, she enjoyed roller skating, listening to music, and being with her friends. She was a sweet girl with a good personality. Despite being a recent high school graduate, Samantha seemed to be unsure of what she wanted to do with her life, but it certainly doesn't seem as though she was planning on straying far from her family or her life in Orange. In September 2010, Samantha was living with her mother and brother in their home on Lindsay Drive, which is in downtown Orange. She didn't have a driver's license, nor did she have a cell phone, which for a 19-year-old in 2010 did strike me as a little odd.
That is weird, yeah.
The cell phone part, not the driver's license part.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that seems kind of weird to me, too, mainly because of how rural that area is.
Yeah, but like I said, she lived in the downtown area. So from what I know about where she was, which, you know, admittedly, I'm not an expert on Orange, but it seems like a lot of stuff was kind of within walking distance to where she was.
Okay.
But she was studying for her driving test because she wanted to get a job and, you know, move toward doing all of that.
But yeah, still very strange that she didn't have a cell phone.
Yeah, I thought so. And that could just be simply because she didn't have a job, you know, and her mom was like, well. So Samantha was such a homebody that once when she spent 2 weeks away in Culpeper, which is a town about 17 miles away from Orange, she called her mother or her aunt, Brenda Rhodes, every day until she came home. Even on a normal day, if she was spending the night away from home, she would always let a family member know. Like, she's just the type of person. She's really close with her family. She was always in touch. In an interview on CNN about 4 months after her disappearance, and this is one of, like, the only early national stories I found about this case, Susan Ferguson Burns, Samantha's cousin, said that her family wasn't aware of any problems that Samantha was facing around the time of her disappearance. However, Samantha had written some concerning MySpace posts in the days leading up to her disappearance. One read, quote, "I hate life. I need help. I don't know what to do. I can't stop hurting or crying and being stupid. Someone please talk to me and calm me down. I don't know what to do," end quote.
That's a concerning post, but it's really vague, so it doesn't really tell us much.
Exactly. And I don't know exactly when it was written. I know it was close to her disappearance, but of course MySpace no longer exists, so right. I can't go back and check.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's hard to say. A few days before that, though, she also wrote, quote, "Damn, I hope everything works out if I am what I think I am. For real, I don't know what to do. It's crazy and confusing," end quote.
If I am what I think I am?
Yep.
Hmm.
Now, people have been speculating, including on this CNN show, that she may have believed that she was pregnant.
Oh, yeah.
But beyond this vague MySpace post, like, there's no other indication or evidence of that.
Mm-hmm.
And she also wrote, quote, "You know, it's funny how people talk shit about you when you're around, but when you're gone, they miss you and they ask about you. WTF, I just don't understand," end quote. So I don't know. That's just an idea of her mindset in the days leading up to September 13th. I don't know how relevant it is.
Right.
But yeah, it's really just one of those things where in the early days of this investigation, when people were kind of hearing about it and looking into it, you know, in 2010, social media was still relatively new and it was really pretty public. So MySpace pages like didn't have any privacy settings or anything like that. And so it was kind of easy for looky-loos to go find things like this. And I think that's what a lot of people did. And that's kind of why this came up. But again, it's just hard to...
It may not be related to her disappearance at all.
Right, right.
Like you said, if it was pregnancy...
Yeah.
We don't have anybody, any of her friends coming forward and saying like, oh yeah, she was pregnant.
No, not that we know of at all.
She was in a relationship with this guy and it ended badly or anything like that. So
nothing like that, no. Now, on the evening of September 13th, as I mentioned in the intro, Samantha was in her pajamas and was just in the living room watching TV at home. It was a seemingly ordinary Monday night and Samantha hadn't mentioned anything really about having plans. Her mother, Brenda, worked third shift, so she left for work around 11:30 p.m. When she left, Samantha was in the living room and Hunter was in his room. She told both of them goodbye and made the five-minute drive to work. Around 12:30, Barbara received a call from her home phone, but she wasn't able to answer it. So she called back around 1:30 a.m. when she was on break. Hunter answered the phone and told her, quote, "Sissy left," end quote. According to Hunter, he had still been in his room when she yelled up the stairs that she was leaving.
And how old was Hunter at this point?
12.
Okay.
Now, Samantha leaving that late at night was a little odd. Barbara said that Samantha rarely went out after dark by herself. Plus, she had no car and there was no public transportation available at that time of night. But Samantha was also 19. She had friends. Like,
right.
You know,
somebody could have come to pick her up.
Exactly. Like, if she wanted to go out, she was perfectly able to do so.
Yeah. Plus, you said she lived in a downtown-ish area.
Yeah.
So she could have walked somewhere.
Yeah, and met up with somebody or, you know, done any number of things.
Yeah.
So when Barbara's shift ended at 7 a.m., she returned home and checked to see if Samantha had returned. When she went into her room, she saw the pajamas that Samantha had been wearing, so she knew that Samantha had changed her clothes before she left. However, nothing else was missing. It only appeared that Samantha had taken her house key. Barbara got Hunter off to school and then went back home to get some rest, hoping that her daughter would be there when she woke up. However, when she awoke a few hours later, Samantha was still gone. Barbara later told NBC News, quote, "I was starting to get worried, so I went to go to the police department to report her, but they told me I had to wait 48 hours to file a missing persons report," end quote. Now, unfortunately, this was the wrong information. According to Orange Police Chief James Fenwick, Barbara initially reported her daughter missing to the sheriff's office, and whatever deputy she spoke with just gave her the wrong information and said that since she's an adult, she has to wait 48 hours, which Fenwick said is absolutely not true.
Ooh. Some competing law enforcement jurisdictions there.
Well, I mean, I think he just wanted to make that clear. So the sheriff's office...
I think he also wanted to make clear that it wasn't Orange County PD yes. that said that.
Very true. Very true. And the sheriff's department and Orange PD, you know, did end up working together very closely on this case. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right. I think right away he was like, no, 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 that wasn't us that
yeah.
said that.
Yeah, yeah.
So the next day on the 15th, Barbara did end up coming to Orange Police Department and reported Samantha missing, and they did immediately start their investigation.
Also, I had no idea that Orange was big enough to have its own police department.
Yeah, I think it's a very small department, but they do
sure,
have it.
Sure, but still, yeah. that's bigger than what I thought they
yeah.
were. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. Fenwick was chief of police until his retirement in 2021, so he's been the point of contact for the majority of Samantha's investigation. While he and his department worked diligently on her case over the years, he remained pretty tight-lipped during that time. Because of that, we've really had to piece together a lot of information about this case. And I'm just going to warn everybody who's listening right now, because of that, I do have to kind of jump back and forth a little bit. It's not as chronological as I usually like to be.
In other words, it's going to confuse me.
It might. But stay with me. We'll get through it together. So one thing that Chief Fenwick did say early on is that they were investigating a group of people whom Samantha had recently met. But it would be years before the public would find out more information. Did you know that your actual age might not be the same as your biological age? That's right, it's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. Hey everyone, it's Kona, host of And Then They Were Gone, and I am coming to you today to talk about True Diagnostic. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part? It's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent straight to your door. True Age is actually sending me a test, and I'm really excited to see what it's going to say about my health. And frankly, a little frightened. Because even though I'm afraid it's going to tell me that my biological age is higher than my normal age, it's definitely information that I can use. Because by tracking my biological age, I can actually see how changes that I make, whether exercise, diet, or sleep, can affect my health over time. And this isn't guesswork. The True Age test is based on peer-reviewed research from scientists working with Harvard, Duke, and Yale. I don't know. I like to know everything, so I think it's going to be really cool to know exactly how my lifestyle is impacting my body. I already know there's definitely room for improvement, and I think this is going to give me some actionable steps. So if you're ready to join me and find out your biological age, right now, my listeners can get 20% off their entire order at truediagnostic.com by using the code ATTWG at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TRUDIAGNOSTIC.com. Just use the code ATTWG to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today. In the early days of the investigation, Samantha's mother and aunt drove around Orange looking for her and handing out missing flyers. Meanwhile, investigators interviewed Samantha's friends and acquaintances. Despite the alarming MySpace posts, it doesn't appear as though police considered Samantha to be a runaway, as I think a lot of other jurisdictions may have done, you know, because you could interpret those as like, I'm depressed, I'm either going to harm myself, I'm going to get out of here, you know.
Yeah, but the fact that the only thing that her mother could identify that was missing, quote unquote missing, was her house key.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't necessarily indicate a runaway, per se.
No, it doesn't. But again, we've seen cases.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah. People just walk out. That's true.
Right. So thankfully, that was not the situation here. It seems as though Samantha leaving like she did was so out of character that they immediately believed that something had happened to her one way or another. Unfortunately, investigators were hamstrung by Samantha's lack of a car or a cell phone.
No way to track her.
Exactly. No vehicle for them to tell people to look out for, like no easy pass that they could track. And there was no cell phone that they could ping or pull records for.
I mean, they may not have even known what she was wearing.
They didn't. No, yeah. That was the other thing. They had no idea what she was wearing when she left.
Yeah. I mean, like maybe her mom could narrow it down. But I mean, like whose parents know what?
Like
clothes,
every item of clothing
a 19-year-old has.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's never been a description of what she was wearing that night. All they had was the computer that they had at home and their home phone records. But those did turn out to give them a pretty big clue. As it turns out, one number had called the home phone 6 times on the evening of September 13th. The phone number belonged to a man named Randy Taylor. Randy was around 45 at the time.
Eey.
Yeah. So what was he doing calling a 19-year-old girl late at night? Because again, I think most, if not all of these calls happened after Barbara went to work. So after 11:30 p.m. Police dug into Taylor, who, as it turns out, had quite a criminal record that had begun back in 1992 with a burglary conviction in Virginia Beach. He was also convicted of arson in 2005, and there were, you know, other smaller charges kind of sprinkled in there as well. Orange police knew about Taylor immediately and looked closely at him because, again, he called the house six times.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, he's their only lead. So.
Right, basically. But the public knew nothing of his connection to Samantha's case until 2 years later in 2012.
Okay.
But let me back up a bit. In February 2011, about 5 months after Samantha's disappearance, Orange police, with the help of Orange and Greene County Sheriff's offices, searched Green Acres Lake, a private lake in Greene County. Though Chief Fenwick wouldn't tell reporters why they were searching this lake or what they found, he did confirm that the search was related to Samantha's disappearance. He told the Orange County Review, quote, "I'm hesitant to use the word progress. The information was sufficient to warrant that effort. It would be absolutely wonderful to find out that she's alive and well, and we're still getting information that that's the case. But the longer the case goes on, the prospects certainly dim," end quote.
There's a lot to make out of that statement. He said that they're still receiving information that that is the case, that she's alive and well, but they're searching a lake, which to me indicates that they're searching for a body, maybe. They could be searching for evidence, but I mean, at this point, what other evidence than a body are they looking for? We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that statement kind of leaves a lot to interpretation.
Well, apparently, and I think this just might be because, you know, it's a small town or whatever, but apparently on social media posts, whether it's social media posts that the police department was making about the case or, you know, that Samantha's like friends and family were making, there were a lot of people posting like, oh, yeah, no, I saw her here or I saw her there, or actually she's dead and she's buried here. Like a lot of stuff like that. And Chief Fenwick at some point went public and was like, you guys got to cut it out. Like, we're doing our own investigation. This is not helping us.
Yeah, no, that because that kind of stuff definitely isn't, especially if it's like, oh, I saw her here. There's going to be follow up with that. And then
there was.
Yeah.
I mean, to their credit, they did follow up with it.
That's good.
But it was all nonsense and it wasted a lot of time.
Right.
So that hindered the investigation. So I think that might have been what he was referring to when he said that they were still receiving information.
Yeah.
But that search of the lake in February turned out to be the first of many. In April, they returned with a diving crew and underwater cameras, as well as like an underwater vehicle, to look for evidence related to Samantha. Now, by this time, by April, so between February and April of 2011, they had been out there seven times.
Wow.
And that's a lot of resources for, again, a small jurisdiction.
Yeah, I mean, that to me indicates that they have some very strong evidence that there's something in there.
Exactly. But nobody knew what that evidence was, where it was coming from, who it could be related to, in terms of a potential suspect.
Yeah.
Like, nobody had any idea. As the months wore on, Fenwick continued to keep specifics close to the vest. But in 2012, someone else decided to talk, Randy Taylor.
Okay.
In an extensive article in The Hook written by Courtney Stewart, we finally fill in a lot of details about what was going on with Samantha in the week leading up to her disappearance and how Randy Taylor ties into it all. The Hook, by the way, is now defunct and has recently been taken offline. So it's, oh gosh, it took me a lot of digging, but I was finally able to find this article on the Wayback Machine. So just as a refresher, Randy Taylor was around 45 years old in September 2010 when Samantha went missing. He also called her half a dozen times on the evening of her disappearance. The Friday night before Samantha went missing, there was a football game at Orange County High School where both Samantha and her mother had attended. The pair decided to go to the game, and afterwards, they stopped by the Northside restaurant near Rutgersville. Now, Northside was more of a bar than a restaurant, but in Virginia, we don't have bars. Every bar is actually a restaurant because you're required to serve a certain amount of food. But this particular bar slash restaurant had a reputation for getting pretty rowdy. While they were there, Samantha started talking to a couple men at the bar who were in their early 20s. Barbara said that the interaction seemed completely normal. Randy Taylor said he was actually also there with those men that night, but Barbara doesn't remember seeing him. Samantha and one of the younger men hit it off, and he actually came back home with Samantha.
And her mom.
And her mom, who, yeah.
Interesting. Slightly awkward, I'm sure.
Yeah. So the man ended up spending the night and left the next day. So the next day was a Saturday, and that entire day, Samantha stayed home, but she spent most of the day chatting with that guy online and on the phone. However, by Sunday, things had changed. Samantha actually became interested in the other young man that he had been with that night.
Okay.
So he invited Samantha to ride with him on a truck repossession expedition to Louisa County, which is like a neighboring county. And it was a whole group of people who went because apparently Randy Taylor was the one who was working as a repo man at that time. So this was like Randy Taylor's job, but seemingly also something they would just kind of do for fun group.
I don't know. Also, I mean, maybe we'll get to this, but what connection does Randy have with these 20-something-year-olds?
That actually is never really explained, just that they were friends.
He just likes hanging out with people half his age?
Well, I mean, it seems like it, yeah.
Yeah.
So they go out on this repo expedition, and Samantha ended up spending the night at the house where the two young men lived. The two guys in their 20s were roommates, and they lived in a brick house on the corner of Route 33 and Albano Road in Orange County. So she spent the night there Sunday night and returned home Monday afternoon, which is the 13th. So that was the last day she's seen, right? But when she came home that afternoon, there was already drama. Now, according to Barbara, the second young man who Samantha was now
interested in,
had a girlfriend.
Okay.
The girlfriend apparently confronted Samantha, and the situation may have turned violent. Samantha told her mother that she had been jumped, though she didn't give her mom details, and Barbara didn't see any like injuries or anything on her. But Randy Taylor apparently knew about all of this and was worried about Samantha. He told The Hook, quote, "I heard the girlfriend saying she wanted to beat her ass," end quote. He also claimed that the second man told his angry girlfriend that, quote, "he'd help," end quote. So Randy says, and this is all, you know, what he's telling The Hook in 2012, that he was afraid they were going to ambush Samantha. So he was so worried about this that he asked the first guy for Samantha's phone number. That man ended up giving Randy Barbara's cell phone number.
Mm.
Randy sent her a few texts thinking that it was Samantha's phone, but this was when Barbara was at work.
Right.
So she didn't answer. That's when Randy got Samantha's home number and made those phone calls.
So why does that require 6 phone calls? And do we know the duration of each phone call?
We don't know the exact duration, but it seems like they were all kind of back to back and short. And Randy does talk about that. According to Randy, he said, quote, "I just told her, stay away from the second man," end quote. He also told her that that man has a criminal history, including a conviction for breaking and entering with intent to commit assault and battery. Now, when Randy was telling the reporter all this in 2012, that charge had actually resulted in a probation violation for which that man was currently wanted.
Mm, interesting.
So Randy also said that Samantha dismissed his concerns and cut the first call short, but told him to call her back. So he did. And then said that they had several phone calls in rapid succession. He also claimed that one of the times that she kind of ended the call was because somebody had come to the door, and that on another call, he heard a male voice in the background, which he did not believe to have been Hunter, her 12-year-old brother.
Oh.
So basically, Randy's story is that he was calling Samantha to warn her and that another man came to her door that night. He also claimed that he made all of these phone calls from his home while his young son was sleeping.
Okay. I mean, I don't buy this story.
Yeah, well, neither did Barbara or the police.
Well, I mean, okay, so he said that he sent text messages to Barbara.
Yes.
Or to Barbara's phone. Thinking that,
mm-hmm.
So that can be proven.
Right. So Barbara does say that he texted her. So that is confirmed.
They can also confirm with Barbara, whether that that first, second, whichever one, one of the guys came home with them that night from the bar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we do. That actually did come from Barbara in that article.
Okay. So that didn't actually come from
Randy.
From Randy.
No. The whole thing about the first night and the guy coming home with them, that all came from Barbara.
Okay. So, but Barbara has said that she didn't remember seeing Randy at the bar that night.
Correct.
With these two other young guys.
Yeah.
So then where are we getting the story about the repo mission? Was that from him, from Randy?
No, that was actually from Barbara as well, because that is what Samantha had told her she was doing on Saturday night. But like, Barbara didn't know like Randy's name or anything,
okay.
You know?
Okay.
I think she figured that part of it out later.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how much of this is true or just complete bullshit.
So I think,
I'm wondering
if it's actually true.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether Randy like inserted himself in what would seemingly be an innocent situation,
mm-hmm.
to kind of let it seem as though he's innocently involved with this missing girl.
Yeah, like he's just the good guy, yes. who's looking out for her.
Right, which I call bullshit.
No, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think a lot of it is true, right? Because, you know, he was a repo man, right? And he is friends with those two guys. And he would have had to call Samantha back because his cell phone was a different area code and their home phone didn't have long distance. So she couldn't call his cell phone. So the only way that they would be able to communicate would be if he called her.
Interesting.
Yeah. So like there are no outgoing calls to Randy, but there couldn't have been. So that makes sense.
Also convenient if you're stalking a girl and she keeps hanging up on you.
Also true. Yeah. But I mean, from what Hunter says, you know, she did leave the house.
Abruptly.
But of her own volition.
Yeah.
You know, she changed her clothes. She told Hunter that she was going out and she'd be back in the morning. Like, it's not like she was.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying it was it was an abduction.
No, not at all. Not from the house at all.
But it just seems fishy that he's like rapidly calling her six times in succession, warning her about. You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
no,
this,
I know. It seems
just
a little,
it
seems like a little much, yeah. Right? And that, again, that's what Barbara and the police thought too.
Especially because he's 45 years old and you said that he has a young son sleeping at home with him. Like, really? You're going to spend that much time while you're
like getting into this weird, like, teenage drama?
Right.
Yeah.
Seems odd.
It does. So the day after Samantha went missing, when Barbara's, you know, freaking out and thinking that she can't file a missing persons report yet, and so she's like kind of going and doing everything herself with her sister, she called the number that Randy had texted her from. So at this point, she didn't know about like the six calls or anything like that.
Right.
But she knew that she got these like weird texts in, you know, late at night while she was at work. So she called the number and spoke to Randy. And he told her the story about wanting to warn Samantha about the other guy and his girlfriend. But here's when things get crazy. After she spoke with Randy, Barbara also got in touch with the first guy, the one who
came home with them
and who had, you know, Barbara's number. So she must have had his, right? And he put her in touch with guy number two and his girlfriend.
Mm.
And they took Barbara on a drive. They took Barbara and her sister Brenda to a lakefront property where Randy kept a camper and would sometimes hold parties. Now, Green Acres Lake is part of a homeowners association, and it has been confirmed that police don't believe that any of the homeowners are involved in Samantha's disappearance. But it does seem like this is the lake that they took Barbara to. The camper could have just been on some land that wasn't, you know, on the lake itself, making him not a homeowner who was involved, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But this would explain all of the months that investigators had spent searching that lake. Barbara said that the couple didn't directly say that Randy had harmed Samantha, but she felt as though that was the implication. She told The Hook, quote, "I figured her body was in that lake." end quote. Now, according to Randy, he had no knowledge of Samantha ever having been at that lake, but he said that the couple was obviously familiar with it.
Okay.
He basically shifted the blame to them, saying that they knew far more about what had happened to Samantha than they were telling investigators. Now, as far as I've been able to find, the names of this man, his girlfriend, or the roommate who came home with Samantha on the first night have never been publicly named. Police have also not detailed what information they were able to get out of them. But what we found out from Randy himself in 2012 is that while they weren't saying anything publicly, police had actually been going after him hard for years.
Well, yeah. I mean, his behavior is shady as shit. He has a camper nearby a lake where he hosts parties for kids, essentially. Like, he's hanging out with all of these 20-something-year-olds when he's in his 50s and he's a repo man.
40s, but yes.
40s, sorry. But, like, yeah, like, everything points towards him because of his shady behavior.
Right. But, I mean, you could say, too, that, like, the day of her disappearance, Samantha came home and said that, like, this girl and his, you know, this girl was out to get her because she was, like, messing with her boyfriend or whatever, right?
Yeah, and I'm sure the police investigated that, too.
Yeah, exactly. We just don't have details about it, right? So, according to Randy, police had harassed him to the point where he had lost his job, his home, and even custody of his son. Now, keep in mind, when this interview is being done is almost exactly 2 years after Samantha's disappearance.
Right.
Randy even contends that police planted evidence and conducted illegal searches.
Okay.
In April 2011, Randy was pulled over after leaving a convenience store in Rutgersville. Police searched his car and found a gun. He was arrested and charged with being a felon in possession of a gun. The problem is, Randy claims that he had never seen that gun before. Now, the traffic stop was carried out on the pretense of a broken license plate light. The encounter escalated and a backup officer with a canine unit was brought in. When everything was over, in addition to that gun charge, Randy was also charged with driving under the influence, carrying a concealed weapon, and driving with a suspended license, which Randy claimed he didn't know was suspended. Okay, so here's where it gets weird, though. When Randy was released from jail, he went back to get his car, only to find that the cops had torn it apart. He says that the seats, door panels, and headliner were all ripped, and the stereo speakers had been pulled out. He also said that the license plate light was missing and that a wire had been cut. I know, it sounds crazy, but give it a second. So while he's like kind of looking at his car and looking at the license plate light and examining everything, he found something pretty alarming, a GPS tracking device. Apparently, police had been tracking him for a while without his knowledge. They also didn't have a warrant to do this, but in their defense, the Supreme Court had not yet ruled that you need a warrant to put a GPS tracking device in somebody's car. That actually came pretty shortly afterwards. But at that time, they didn't need one. So Randy took the GPS tracker off of his car, but didn't really know what to do with it. So he was working at a used car dealership at the time. He took it to work and asked if he could store it in the safe there. So his boss agreed. Randy put the GPS tracker in the safe. According to Randy, within 24 hours, 10 guys showed up demanding the device back. He said that they weren't in uniform, so he wasn't exactly sure who they were. Long story short, Randy consulted an attorney who advised him to turn the device over if they would sign a receipt for it. They didn't want to sign for it, though, and one officer allegedly snatched the device out of Randy's coworker's hand. The coworker then called 911. Major Randy Sneed responded and confirmed that the man trying to take the tracker was in fact a police officer, but still refused to sign for it. All of this ended up with the charges against Randy being thrown out because once this all made it to court, the judge ruled that the stop and the subsequent search were illegal. So it turns out they had actually put a GPS tracker on him. And the problem is that I don't want to get too much into the weeds on this, but like the one article I read about this, it was a bunch of different jurisdictions involved. So it was like Greene County Police, like Orange County Police, it was Orange Police Department. basically the tracker's batteries were running low. And so I forget which jurisdiction, but one of them was following him in order to basically get to a point where he could replace the batteries on the tracker. But then another cop got up and testified, was like, oh, yeah, no, it was just a normal traffic stop. And his license plate was out, and that's why we pulled him over. So, like, basically, they were all contradicting themselves. The judge is like, all right, absolutely not. Yeah. Threw the whole thing out.
Yeah.
Now, while this was the latest incident of what Randy Taylor called harassment by the cops, because this had all just kind of finished up in early 2012, just a few months before this interview, it wasn't the first incident. He said that it had actually all started in 2011, about 7 months after Samantha's disappearance. He says that Detective Okerson, who was the lead investigator on Samantha's case, would show up at his home and work multiple times per day. He also says that police showed up at his home with a search warrant and tore it apart, and then claimed to have found a small bit of marijuana, which Randy denies he had had in his home. He told The Hook, quote, I had six officers all on me saying that if I sign a piece of paper saying they found it in my house, they wouldn't arrest me, end quote.
Okay.
362 days later, they showed up with an arrest warrant for that marijuana charge.
Okay.
Randy also said that he had been pulled over multiple times for various reasons and was told that his license was suspended even after he had had it reinstated. He even said that Okerson showed up at a restaurant that he was at while he was on a date. Now, apparently a lot of the GPS incident was actually the Greene County Sheriff's Department and not Orange Police. Like I said, we're dealing with a lot of different agencies here. But as for the allegations against Detective Okerson, who's with Orange, Chief Fenwick said, quote, I have complete faith in Detective Okerson's moral compass. And if either Taylor or his attorney make a formal complaint about misconduct, I would welcome an investigation, end quote.
Yeah, okay, so all of this stuff that you're saying, it's coming from Randy, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I'm going to side with the chief of police on this. Like, bring it on, basically. Like, if you're saying all of these things, make a formal complaint and we'll investigate. Like, it seems like it's all bullshit until it's investigated.
Absolutely. As with a lot of what Randy says, there is some truth to it. Because it went to court.
Yeah,
and the judge was like, yeah, no, these cops are being shady about this.
About the GPS,
right. And the traffic stop, right?
Right.
So, like, there is definitely some truth to it. The question is, how much?
Right.
Randy Taylor's attorney, Adam Ray, says that while he was initially skeptical of his client's story, he began to believe him, saying, quote, they wanted to get him for anything. What worries me is they're going so overboard. If they can't find a crime, they'll invent one, end quote. And honestly, given what happened in court, like, I get where his attorney's coming from.
Yeah, and we have seen it in cases before where police get so narrow in their focus during investigations
that
they hone in on one person and
just fit,
ignore everything
else.
Yeah,
and they just try to make the evidence fit
instead
that
of
theory,
following
right?
the evidence.
So yeah, so at this point, you've got to ask, was this a case of tunnel vision? Were police, who have dealt with very few cases like this, in over their heads and just desperately trying to get a conviction? And listen, it certainly may have seemed that way in 2012, but everything in this case changed in 2013 when another young woman went missing. On August 13th, 2013, 17-year-old Alexis Murphy left her home in Shipman, Virginia to go shopping in Lynchburg. She never returned. Police investigated her disappearance, but unlike in Samantha's case, they had a lot more to go on. They knew the direction she was heading. She was driving her own car, a 2003 Nissan Maxima, and she had a cell phone. Because of this, within days, they were able to track her movements to a Liberty gas station in Lovingston. They pulled surveillance video and saw Alexis on August 3rd, shortly after she left home. They also saw a man talking to Alexis and holding the door for her. That man was Randy Taylor.
Uh-huh.
On August 6th, Alexis's car was found abandoned in a movie theater parking lot in Albemarle County, right outside of Charlottesville. Over the next few days after Randy Taylor was identified, Nelson County investigators secured a search warrant for Randy's camper. So Nelson County is where she went missing from, and that's also where Randy was living then.
Okay.
So she lived in Shipman, and he lived in Lovingston, and that's where the gas station was, but those two towns are very close together.
And how far away is this from Orange, Virginia?
So it's about like an hour and a half, I want to say. So Charlottesville is kind of the central point between these two places.
Gotcha.
During the initial search of Randy's camper, police found a torn fingernail, a stud earring, and a strand of hair. DNA testing later confirmed that the hair was Alexis's, and Randy Taylor was arrested for her abduction. Now, according to Randy, Alexis had been in his camper on August 3rd, but she was there with another man, a man named Damian Bradley.
Okay, here we go again.
Yep. He said that he had bought marijuana from Damian and smoked it with him. He then said that this man and Alexis left in separate cars, and he doesn't know what happened after that.
So a torn piece of fingernail, a piece of her hair, and what else?
An earring.
Right. So all of that just happened. Just normal stuff, right? Yeah, just normal stuff.
I leave that stuff at people's houses constantly.
Yeah, after like smoking pot.
Yeah.
You just like suddenly shed all of your body parts.
Right. Yeah. No.
The hair, okay, fine.
Sure.
Sure. But like,
yeah.
A piece of a fingernail and an earring.
Well, and that's the thing. And the fingernail was really what got police, right? Because it's like the hair is hair. You know, people shed hair.
Yeah.
And even the earring. Earrings have been known to fall out.
Sure.
But the fingernail, they said, was clearly torn. Yeah. And so that was really what made investigators suspicious.
Yeah.
And so basically his story is like they met at the gas station. He had been talking about wanting to smoke some pot. And then she was like, oh, yeah, I know a guy. They're apparently strangers, he and Alexis. But then like this guy gets involved. So the three of them end up at the camper.
Yeah.
And then Alexis and the guy leave. Yeah. In separate cars.
So another story where there's some other guy.
He's
totally innocent. Like,
yeah.
I'm not doing anything wrong other than hanging out with
now
underage.
17.
Yeah. Now 17. Underage
yeah.
girl.
And now he's 47.
Yeah. Like, give me a fucking break. Like,
no, it's
this all of the earmarks of a pedophile.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, sure. Close to 18, but
not close enough.
Not okay.
No. And so, I mean, she was a senior in high school.
Ugh.
Like, she was apparently going to Lynchburg to like get her hair done for her senior portraits. I mean, she's a child. What's crazy is, you know, I read a lot of articles that talk about how Randy is like, oh no, there was this third guy and that must have been it. But then I did read one article, I believe it was News Nation, who actually named Damian Bradley. And I was like, oh, so he gave an actual name. And so police are like, yeah, Damian Bradley exists. He knows of Alexis, which is wild to me because Randy apparently knew that. I mean, he knew enough to like give them that name, right? So police had to look into it because it seemed plausible. So they talked to Damian Bradley and Damian's like, yeah, no, I know who Alexis is, but I don't know Randy.
Mm-hmm.
I've certainly never been to his camper with or without Alexis. And furthermore, I was not even remotely in the area that weekend. So it turns out Damian Bradley was with his father in Alabama that entire weekend.
Well, there we go.
Yeah. So like, you know, and again, they obviously confirmed this, blah, blah, blah. So once Damian Bradley was kind of ruled out, they obviously went back to Randy. On a subsequent search of the camper, in which the investigators themselves came out and said, like, we weren't really expecting to see anything, to find anything, because they're like, you know, it's a camper.
Yeah.
It's not like it's that much space. But apparently, underneath a sofa, they found a rolled up T-shirt that had blood on it. And inside the shirt, like rolled up in it, were a set of false eyelashes and a bloody hair extension. These were also DNA tested in addition to, you know, the items that they initially found, and everything
came back to Alexis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you could say a strand of hair here, an earring there, but a bloody extension and false eyelashes wrapped up in a bloody t-shirt.
Yeah.
A little harder to explain.
Mm-hmm. Damien left that.
Yeah. So Randy had already been arrested for her abduction, right? And so he'd already been arrested when they went and did the second search. And then obviously the DNA testing took time. So he was already in jail awaiting his trial on the abduction when they found all this out. Once they got all this evidence, they upgraded the charges. On January 16th, 2014, the abduction charge that Randy Taylor was facing was upgraded to first-degree murder. He was also charged with first-degree felony murder and abduction with the intent to defile, but they still didn't have Alexis's body. Despite that, Randy Taylor went on trial for Alexis's abduction and murder on May 1st, 2014. On May 8th, the jury found him guilty.
Well, that was quick.
Yeah, like a week-long trial, and that was it.
Wow.
Throughout the entire arrest and trial, Randy Taylor maintained his innocence and swore that Alexis had been with someone else.
Then how did that shit end up in your trailer? Underneath a couch?
Yeah.
Is he going to say the cops planted that evidence on him too?
I don't know if he said that or not. He's found guilty, and then it's sentencing. Two life sentences is what he got.
Mm.
Clearly, that made him rethink a few things.
Mm-hmm.
Now he wanted to make a deal. So at sentencing, he said, hey, I'll tell police where Alexis Murphy is in exchange for a 20-year sentence. But Alexis's family wasn't having it. Her aunt, Angela Murphy, said, quote, I couldn't rest, or my family couldn't rest, knowing that we didn't do all that we could when we had the opportunity to put this monster away forever. End quote. Alexis's family desperately wanted to find her and lay her to rest, but they were also convinced that if Randy Taylor got out of prison in 20 years, he would just strike again. And I just find that so emotional because it's such a selfless act and must have been so difficult for her family.
Yeah.
At that point, they knew she was gone. They knew that they weren't going to get a happy ending, and I can't imagine the desperation they must have felt to know where she was and to bring her home. But they decided to forego that so they could save the next girl. Anthony Martin, who was the Nelson County Commonwealth's attorney at the time, said, quote, we'll keep looking and hopefully find her, but we're not going to give in to him, end quote. And I have to think that Samantha's disappearance kind of played into this, right? Because at this point, Anthony Martin, the Commonwealth's attorney, fully believed that Randy Taylor was responsible for her disappearance as well. He did not think that Alexis Murphy was his first victim.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And so by extension, neither did the family. And they said that in interviews. You know, one of her relatives were like, yeah, we knew this was not his first rodeo. Like, he had done this before, and mm-hmm. he'll do it again.
Yeah.
Martin said, quote, Randy Taylor has done this before with the case in Orange County. He has not been charged yet. That's still an active investigation, end quote. And I just really, I didn't even write this in because, like, it was just getting to be too much in terms of, like, getting into the weeds of Alexis's case when I want to focus on Samantha's. But I do want to bring it up now because you mentioned stalking Samantha.
Yeah.
And, you know, when he made those, like, six phone calls and you brought that up. Once Randy Taylor was identified as a suspect in this, one of Alexis's aunts was like, you know what? That guy looks familiar. It turns out that he had sold her a used car. Or, like, he worked at the dealership where she bought her car and had been the one who handed her the keys. Mm. And I think Alexis had been with her at you know, one of the trips to the car dealership. And also at that gas station, he was known to just, like, go to the gas station and park and just watch people.
Yeah.
So, like, Alexis is somebody who he had seen before, who was known to him, who people believe he may have just kind of been fixated on.
Yeah.
and that his encounter with her on August 3rd was not random.
Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't.
So they didn't accept the deal that Randy proposed after he was found guilty and sentenced, and Randy went to prison. Despite a double life sentence, Randy Taylor didn't give any information about Samantha Clark.
Well, he can't. If he does, that's new charges and a new trial. And it, whatever the outcome of that would have nothing to do with the sentence for Alexis.
Well, right. But I mean, if you think he's already in there serving a double life sentence, then what does he have to lose? Is he going to serve a triple life sentence?
Well, maybe he's hoping for an appeal.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe. So he wasn't saying anything, but in 2020, I don't know if it's karma because of the difficult decision that Alexis's family made or what. But for some reason, even without a deal, in late 2020, Randy Taylor decided to talk again, and he told investigators where they could find Alexis's body. On December 3rd, 2020, Alexis Murphy's remains were located on a property near Stagebridge Road along Route 29 in Lovingston, which is the town where Alexis was last seen and where Randy Taylor lived at the time. They also looked for Samantha in the area, but no trace of her was found. In January 2021, Samantha Clark's case was reclassified from a missing person to an abduction and homicide case. According to Chief Fenwick, this was due to new information and advances in investigative and forensic technology. Though Alexis's remains had been found shortly before this announcement, that actually hadn't been made public yet. So this was actually kept secret for a while to give the family time to grieve privately and to make funeral arrangements before the press knew. So the actual announcement about Alexis's remains wasn't made until February 2021. So that is likely the new information that Chief Fenwick was referring to in January.
Yeah.
Despite the case being over a decade old, both Chief Fenwick and Orange County Commonwealth Attorney Diana O'Connell said that it was still being heavily investigated, especially because Randy Taylor had been their suspect from day one. Fenwick told reporters, quote, "We have expended, you know, untold amounts of resources in this case and will continue to. That is of no concern. We're going to do what we need to do to be able to get answers for Samantha's family," end quote. You know, honestly, I believe him.
Well, yeah. They've kept the case open this long. They haven't shelved it.
No.
Like we have seen in some other cases.
Yeah.
Like this is very much still active and they're still pursuing him. So it clearly wasn't just tunnel vision. They knew they had him.
Yeah. They just didn't have the physical evidence.
Right.
And that's what I was trying to understand when I was learning about Alexis's case, because, you know, when they put him on trial for her abduction and murder, they didn't have her body. So my question was like, what made it different? Why were they able?
They had physical evidence.
They had physical evidence.
Right.
And they had electronic evidence that led them to the physical evidence.
Right.
And it just, I don't want to say it's luck, but there was just a lot more working in Nelson County's favor.
Right.
In Alexis's case.
Yeah.
It was a lot of good investigative work. You know, I'm not saying that they just
stumbled upon
the answer. Because they did some really interesting things in that investigation that really got them to where they needed to be. But it's just heartbreaking that those things just seemingly were not available in Samantha's case. And because of that, even though they've got the same suspect, you know, a very similar crime.
Yeah, same MO.
Right. Same like bullshit story.
Even potential, well, not same, but very similar locations of the offenses.
Yeah.
You know, he moves to a different location, sets up a trailer in the woods.
Yeah. The other thing that I didn't even put in that I should mention, too, is that so they found Alexis's body, like I said, you know, off the side of a road. Right. But before they found her body, I think quite a while before, they found her sweater that she'd been wearing that day in a lake.
Mm.
it was a different lake. I mean, it was one, you know,
obviously
where he lived now. It wasn't the one that they had been looking for in terms of Samantha. It was in Green Acres. But like, he had dumped evidence
in a lake.
In a lake.
Yeah. Yeah. That's his MO. And now, I mean, I would honestly be curious, and I don't know who would look into this or whatever, but I'd be curious to find out where else he lived.
Yeah.
And if he has a tendency to relocate to areas in rural Virginia around lakes, and he sets up trailers, because I'm willing to bet that Samantha wasn't his first victim either.
Yeah. I mean, did he randomly just start killing in his mid-40s?
No.
And, you know, so they did look at him in other cases in the area around that time. Again, going back to Morgan Harrington, like, they looked at him for that, too. And when Jesse Matthews was found to be her killer, likewise, they looked at Jesse Matthews in Alexis's case and in Samantha's case. Mm. But they don't believe that there, you know, was any connection there. But yeah, how many other girls are there out there?
Yeah, we don't know. I mean,
that's
why I'd be curious to see if they could track down where he lived previous to Samantha's case.
Well, and that's the thing, and I'm sure they have, because again, I don't think anybody thinks that he just randomly started this, right?
Yeah.
So I do believe that those investigations have been going on behind the scenes, you know, what they found, who knows.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it is. That is an important thing to look at. This guy is clearly
serial.
Yeah.
Serial rapist and murderer
mm-hmm.
of young women.
Young girls.
Yep.
Yeah. Chief Fenwick firmly believed that someone out there has information that can break this case wide open. Now, obviously, that person is Randy Taylor, but there could be others. There are still the two young men and the girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, they could know more than they were saying, you know, maybe things they were afraid to say at the time.
Right.
That maybe they could say now that Randy Taylor is
serving two life sentences.
Exactly. Right. And to your point, maybe people who knew Randy Taylor earlier in his life, you know, maybe they have information, not necessarily about Samantha, maybe about other victims.
Yeah, and the victims don't necessarily have to be homicide victims or
right.
rape victims. I mean, typically, you don't go from 0 to 100. I mean, in cases like this, rapist murderers, it starts off small.
Yeah.
In particular, pedophiles doing small things from stalking, sexual harassment, sexual assault, to eventually building up to abduction, rape, murder.
Yeah, and we know what his criminal history is, but we also know that a lot of crimes like that don't get reported.
Right.
So, yeah, I think there are more people out there who can shed light on Randy Taylor, his actions, his crimes, and hopefully what happened to Samantha Clark. Samantha Clark is out there. She's out there somewhere, and she's been waiting to be found. She deserves to be found. The only question that remains is who is going to give the answer. Samantha Clark has been missing from Orange, Virginia since September 13th, 2010. She's a white female with brown hair and brown eyes. At the time of her disappearance, she was approximately 5'4" and 145 pounds. She has 3 tattoos, a Playboy bunny on her right arm, 2 dolphins on her lower back, and a Tigger tattoo on her right ankle. Samantha was 19 when she went missing. She would be 33 today. Anyone with more information on Samantha Clark's disappearance is asked to contact the Orange Police Department at 540-672-1491. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.